Blog Talk Radio. Evening and welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon. I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry, also known as Jennifer Perry. And I have to say, I want to thank everyone who's listening. If you're listening live tonight on Blog Talk Radio, please click the button that says follow, if you would, so I can see how many people are following here. And it also helps my sponsors as well, which also helps me bring you more excellent guests. And lately, it has just been been fantastic. See, I had Dr. Rajiv Partee talking about his book, Dying to Wake Up. That was fantastic. Heather Ash Amara, the love, the warrior goddess. We've had Frank DeVille Greenville, and he is he's a producer, writer. He's gone platinum 6 times of work he's done for Timbaland. He's worked for Beyonce, Usher, and right now he's on tour with the Gap Band. We had Rudy Sarzo last week from you may know from Quiet Riot and Blizzard of Ozzy, Whitesnake. But right now, he's written a book off the rails, and he's also a very active mentor and animal activist. And coming up soon, we're going to have Kasim Sultan, bass player for Todd Rundgren, and Meatloaf, and a whole lot of other people. And you may remember not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, we had Randy Blazak on. Randy, who you may know is sociologist. Randy Blazak, sociologist, and he is the director of Hate Crime Research Network, the co-founder of Oregon Spotlight, which monitors hate groups, and he's the chair of the Oregon Coalition Against Hate Crimes. And he was here talking about his newest book, The Dream Police. It's fantastic. You've got to get it. And he's joining me tonight as co-host and our special guest. And I'm so glad to have you here, Randy. Hello.
Hey. I'm sitting in the co-host chair tonight. It's very comfy.
Yeah. That's what I was saying. You know, because Randy's been here before, so he knows that, as Robert Leland once told the world in the very beginning, that Madame Perry Salon looks like the inside of Jeannie's bottle. So Randy even has his own little couch, his own little cushion over there. And we're gonna. I'm so excited, Randy. I'm so psyched about tonight's guest. You know I am. And well, we've got him a nice fluffy cushion to sit on too as he comes in through the beaded curtains. And let me introduce to you the Harvey J.K. Harvey J.K., welcome to Madame Perry Salon. Come on in.
I feel like I'm the last, but I hope not least. You've had quite a roster of folks who've been there, and Randy, it's very nice to meet you.
You too.
Well, I was just trying to lead up to you.
To me?
Mr. K. Yes.
Well,
yes.
You're I'm the, sitting you're the, up... Sorry. I mean, all those folks. I mean, hell, I'd love to perform with Todd Rundgren myself.
Oh my God, you're a Todd fan?
Because you know, I don't want to work. I just want to bang on my drum all day.
Harvey, I already knew I liked you. Didn't think it could go any higher, but it just did. So yeah, I'm so excited. Kasim Sultan's going to be here on the 24th. And you are welcome to call in. Be delighted.
That's
and
nice.
You too.
Very
and
nice. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
And, yeah, I've been seeing him with the Todd since Utopia. And he's a busy fellow. He's quite a guy. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. But tonight, we're here to talk about you. Now, Randy, sometimes when Randy Blazak's on, he makes me call him Dr. Blazak sometimes. I think it just depends on the mood he's in.
That's only if my mother is listening.
That's wonderful. let me put it this way. When I started teaching, and I think I was 26 when I taught my first university class, 20, or maybe it was younger, but with a PhD, maybe 26. And I remember saying to my students, they wanted to know what they should call me, and I said, look, you can call me doctor, you can call me professor, just don't call me mister. That implies age more than intellect. And I said, the best thing to do is just call me Harvey. And now we're 40 years later, and I guess you should call me Harvey too, right?
It's up to you.
That's what I'd like most of all.
Okay. You don't have to call me madam. You can call me Jennifer.
I was going to ask you if it's Jen or Jennifer. That's really good. And by the way, what I was going to say is that I actually prefer people calling me Harvey, okay? Maybe it keeps me feeling younger, so please do.
I can dig it. Well, you're a pretty young guy. All the pictures I found of you to put up here, you know, you're so young and fit and trim. So, listen, we are thrilled to have you. And if you're just tuning in, just so you know, you will be able to call in and talk with or make a comment to Harvey and to Randy. See, we're such good pals now. I feel so hip. We're on a first-name basis. Harvey J. Kay, he's the author and editor of numerous works, including The American Radical, Are We Good Citizens?, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, which Randy says he could talk about all day, and the newest, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. You also teach at the University of Wisconsin, I believe, on American history, politics, and society. Am I right?
Right. It's the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay. We were set up in the 60s, long before I ever got here. But we were set up in the 60s as the somewhat experimental alternative campus of the University of Wisconsin system. And I think one of the reasons I got the job here was because I didn't fit in at 99% of the other places. And what I mean by that is I had degrees in history, political science, and sociology. And I'm a historian and sociologist. But most schools, as Randy can probably attest, just generally speaking, don't like people who are too nomadic, right?
Yeah, I mean, they really want you to kind of stay in your lane and maybe do some collaboration with other folks, but you really can't collaborate with yourself. You have to have sort of one hat
right.
that you wear, and it makes it easier for them to keep track of you and where you belong.
Yeah, well, I originally trained in Latin American studies, and then I moved into British studies in the 80s, and I was getting very frustrated politically with the way things were, and I'd been writing about Thatcher in Britain and Reagan in the United States around late 80s, and I thought the only way to make a political difference was to turn myself into an Americanist, and through the course of the early 90s, that's pretty much what I did. So here I am.
So tell me, now, let's start with a little background on you. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school?
I was born in Englewood, New Jersey in 1949. My parents were classic Greatest Generation parents. My father had served in the U.S. Army during the Second World War and, in fact, was in the tanks in the Battle of the Bulge, was wounded, received the Purple Heart, and after the war, when he came back, he and my mother got married, and I was born first child, 1949. So I grew up around New York City, most of all on the Jersey side of the Hudson River, ending up in Paramus, New Jersey, which in the native tongue it means land of wild turkeys. Just for the record. And I grew up in New Jersey. And sorry.
I'm sorry. Randy, did you know that?
No, I'm learning something. You know, living here in Oregon, we everything is named after Native American, so it usually just means a Native American version of "it's gonna rain today." So,
yeah, I've only been in Oregon once, but four of the 5 days I was there, I think it was raining. Yeah, four of the 5 days. But I loved Portland, just for the record. That's where you are usually, right?
Yeah,
Portland?
Yeah, it's a great,
place. Yeah, no, I loved Portland. I thought that was magnificent. I'm sure everyone tells you that. So I grew up in New Jersey mostly, say 20 miles from Times Square, and I happened to be an exchange student in South America, which is what led me originally to Latin American studies, and I went to Rutgers College, as it was known then, in New Jersey in the late 60s, early 70s, but I spent my, sorry, am I getting too autobiographical here? If I am, just stop me, okay? I spent my junior year at the National University of Mexico as the Rutgers guinea pig, should they create an exchange program or not, and I was the guinea pig, and it was wonderful. And when I was studying there, I pretty much decided the only way I could afford really to both study and travel was to do it as a student. So I went to the University of London, University College and London School of Economics for my master's degree. And then I came back and I spent, and here's a confession I don't often tell everyone, I actually spent not quite a year on Wall Street as a international lending officer trainee with one of the big four British banks. It was actually the only job I could get at the time. Every time I went in to find something just to keep me going or what I thought might be more honest, they thought I was a union organizer, which I wasn't, but that's what they thought. So I ended up on Wall Street, and I within months after I started, I actually had the good fortune of getting offered assistantships and fellowships to do a PhD here in the States. Mostly because I spoke Spanish, I had traveled overseas, I had more than one discipline, somehow or other for PhD purposes, people like that. And I ended up going to Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge to study basically agrarian studies of Latin America, it was an amazing switch from history to international relations to agrarian studies, but it fascinated me. I was particularly interested in landlord-peasant relations, and somehow we used to say that Louisiana was the northernmost country of Latin America and seemed to be the right place to be. So I got the PhD, finished up, and the job market in the mid-70s for PhDs, I know it's never been great ever since, but it really was abysmal in the mid-70s. So I was back in New York for a while, for a year, had some part-time stuff at Columbia University. And then I came out here to the Upper Midwest, and I'll make the longer story short by saying I came to University of Wisconsin-Green Bay because the university was established as an interdisciplinary problem-focused university. There were several of them around the country. Up in the Northwest where you are, Randy, there's Evergreen in Washington, and then down in California, and then UC Santa Cruz. And we were the Upper Midwestern rendition of all of that. And the department that I came to was then called Social Change and Development, which was pretty much what the area that I was in before I, you know, made my nomadic migration to American history. So I've been in Wisconsin now for, 39 years. This is my 39th year here, actually. That's amazing. That number of years always freaks me out when I say it out loud. So, yeah. And I can say that it's been great in many ways. I mean, it's a good city, Green Bay. I've become a huge Packers fan, and if your audience doesn't know it, I'll let them know that the Green Bay Packers are the only fan-owned franchise in professional sports in the United States. Whereas one New York Times sports columnist wrote, "Socialism is alive and well in Green Bay, Wisconsin."
I've always wondered that if Packers fans have a more favorable view of socialism than, you know, say the Atlanta Falcons fans or the New York Yankees fans, where it's all about the money.
Well, you know, it's interesting to consider this, that we were the ones who inaugurated what became known as the Lambeau Leap, and other stadiums, sports people try to do it, where a player, if he scores, jumps into the stands at the end zone area and basically jumps into the fans' arms. And as I said, where else but in Green Bay, Wisconsin, would players jump into the arms of the owners of the team, right?
Right.
So, there's a certain affection there. It's also the case, however, sadly enough, that in contrast, say, to the Western states, Green Bay, which was the home of progressive politics in many ways during the 20th century, Joe McCarthy aside, it really is tragically now Republican-dominated, and it's severely affected public life, social services, and the state of the university. So I came for the university, and maybe I stay for the team now, something like that.
Oh. So,
that's me.
Randy, did you have a question for us before I keep going?
Well, I mean, you use the term Americanist as you kind of develop your scholarly agenda, and I'm wondering, the two hats I wear as a sociologist and a criminologist, Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we have a little bit of overlap in the interest of both social justice and the justice system itself. But could you define for people in general outside of your little niche what you mean by that? Because I think that's a term that gets thrown around by folks who have very different definitions of what that means within academia.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll confess to you right away that I don't actually have a good definition for justice. That's in the program that I'm in, Democracy and Justice Studies. I'm on the democracy side more than the justice side.
Right, but you talked about how when you were developing, finding a sort of a place for you in academia, that there was this Americanist position that you could take in taking on these issues. Is that the word used, Americanist?
Yeah, that's a term that I do use. Let me segue back to it by way of my grandfather, if that's okay. People sometimes would ask me, "Well, how did you first become interested in history?" And then somebody else might ask, "How did you first become interested in questions of, say, justice and democracy?" And I can tell you that before there was any notion of theory, or even practice for that matter, I had this historical sensibility about those things, in good part from when I was really pre-literate, before I could ever read. My grandparents, who lived in Brooklyn, New York, used to come out to our house in New Jersey, and my grandfather bought me, I still have it in fact, this sort of coffee table sized golden book collection of Old Testament Bible stories. And he would read these stories, not simply as, you know, sort of tales of good and bad or good and evil, but he would read them with a sense of history, in that he would talk about them as if they really happened. But he would also weave into those stories sort of references to when he was growing up in the early 20th century on the Lower East Side in Manhattan, which is where the overwhelming majority of Jewish immigrants were living. And he would talk about, you know, the socialist politics. I was only 4 or 5 years old. But he would talk about these things as if history really was about questions of freedom and equality and, to use, you know, our modern notion of democracy. So in some ways it became sort of instinctive to me, questions like that. And I think to this day that if somebody says to me, "What do you mean by justice?" I really don't know if I could answer it, though I can tell you that my sense of justice has to do with enhancing people's capacities to not simply choose for themselves, but to take part in a larger conversation at a community or even national level to determine what the choices would be in American life. Randy, I imagine at some point you read C. Wright Mills' The Sociological Imagination.
Of course. It's the first lecture in my intro classes.
By the way, in spite of the fact that my work is all in history, since I'm in this interdisciplinary university, for 30 years I taught intro sociology, okay? And I taught the whole course around C. Wright Mills' Sociological Imagination, and there's that chapter on reason and freedom, and I loved that, you know, talking to my students about questions of freedom and questions of equality, with the idea that really, and he doesn't talk about it quite like this, though he emphasizes it between the lines, is that freedom and equality really do depend upon democratic practices, and that people are engaged and they're participating in the choices that a community should arrive at. So I think my sense of justice really has to do comes out of that. And the fact that my grandfather, I forgot to mention, was a trial lawyer, and he defended everyone from gangsters' girlfriends to poor black workers. And I remember talking to him a great deal about questions, isn't exactly justice, but about questions of guilt and innocence and the role of the lawyer and this whole idea of innocent until proven guilty. And I remember he one time said that I was young, and he said, "You know, what you don't quite understand is that it really is the case that you're not guilty until you're proved guilty." And my job is to maximize that argument. And in many ways, he said, "I'm there to protect the principal as much as I am, you know, the accused." So, you know, somewhere between there is my sense of justice, between that freedom, equality, and democracy, my grandfather's sense of what was right versus what was wrong.
Interesting. I think I had that same big book that you were talking about, the big hardbound.
Yeah,
book of Bible.
Big hardbound, right.
I had that book, and I carried it, big as it was, I carried that with me almost everywhere. I love that book.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It amazed me that I still actually have it. It's in rather tattered shape when I recovered it from my parents' home some years back. But I kept it as just a reminder of where these ideas came from. Plus, the pictures were really stunning. I mean, the illustrations,
yeah.
The language, and as I read it as an adult or as a young adult, I remember reading it thinking there was no way that my grandfather actually read the text to me, because the text was definitely not meant for a child. The text was definitely written at a very sophisticated level, and he must have been putting it into his own words. If you go back and look at it, Jennifer, you'll see what I mean.
I will, and thank you for that. Did you, now, is this, are you also talking about, is all of this that you've just described, this is where your interest in history and progressive politics, is that where this came from or was generated?
Right. I mean, I you know, it's just talking about my youth here. I mean, I remember the first time that this question of politics came up was probably, I don't know, I must have been 12, 13, 14. And the civil rights struggle was the first really big question in my head politically. And I grew up in a Jewish home where questions of equality and questions of what it means to be an American were just, there was almost a sense they were taken for granted. And anything that didn't live up to those documents that I really believe so much in, I mean, I really to this day still do believe in the preamble of the Declaration, the preamble of the Constitution, the key First Amendment in the Bill of Rights. I'm really leaving out the most fundamental part of the story. Can I, if you don't mind, I'm going to go back on this. I do tell the story quite often. When I was about 8, 9, or 10 years old, my father's father and my grandmother lived in Brooklyn. Both sets of my grandparents lived in Brooklyn. They were very close friends. In fact, my parents knew each other when they were 5 years old. So the whole family was kind of, it was small but very close-knit kind of family. And my grandfather, the trial lawyer, had this great apartment on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, which is right across from the Brooklyn Museum, which I used to call the Brooklyn Museum of Art because that's what it was filled with. And when my grandmother had become very ill and she would pass away fairly young, we used to regularly go to their apartment to see them. And they had a fairly large apartment. And when a cousin would be there, a second cousin, an older second cousin, I would try to get the second cousin to take me over to the museum because it was filled not just with works of art, but it even had an Egyptology section with imagine if you're 9 or 10 years old, with an unwrapped mummy. And
ooh.
I just thought that was, it was just fascinating. So, and I especially knew when I had to try to leave the apartment, because my grandparents at that point would start talking to my parents by using Yiddish words, the old East European Jewish language. That was a sign that I should probably leave the room. And if a cousin was there, then I could leave the apartment. But if no cousin was there, I knew that was the signal to wander the apartment as if it was the museum. So I would go room to room as if each was a gallery. And I would always end up and they actually had their own dining room in this apartment. I would end up at the far end of the dining room, sort of the head of the dining room table. And behind that head of the table was a set of bookshelves where my grandfather kept not his law books but his personal library. And I would just, rummage through the shelves. And obviously 99% of it was far beyond anything I could make sense of. But I would eventually sit down on the floor, and I do remember about the third shelf up or second shelf up at eye level, there was this one particular book that was in red, white, and blue, and most of the other books didn't have that color wrapping. And I kept grabbing for this one, and little by little I just embraced this book. And the book was written by a man named Joseph Lewis, who was an old atheist a major, major fan, a fanatic for Thomas Paine. And in this book, he argued that the real author of the Declaration of Independence was Thomas Paine, not Thomas Jefferson. And I loved that because it showed that all of my school teachers had been wrong about who wrote the Declaration. You know, as a 10-year-old, you don't realize that some books could be, you know, bullshit. And as and I saw this, and I took it as truth, because if it was in a book that my grandfather owned, it had to be true. So I would go, you know, I'd go into school, and whenever there was a history test, I never actually got 100% on the history test at any point to my recollection through elementary or high school, because I was insistent on, at least for the fun of it, challenging my teachers by saying Thomas Paine was the author of the Declaration. And this was the book that sort of made me wonder who this Thomas Paine was. And when my grandmother passed away, which was actually only about a year or two after much of this was happening, my grandfather downsized into a smaller place and gave me some of the Thomas Paine books he had, which at the time, at 10 or 11 years of age, didn't mean a great deal. But when I was in high school, I started to, you know, started to read through them, Age of Reason, Rights of Man, and, of course, his classic Common Sense, which I still think everyone should read or at least have a copy of next to their bedside, you know, alongside the bed. Well, anyhow, so Thomas Paine became my hero intellectually, politically. He was my guy. So for years and years and years, whenever, you know, the chance arose for me to link up with Thomas Paine, I did. And then to go back to your question, the thing is that Paine in many ways was this means by which I became an Americanist. And sort of by re-embracing Paine in a bigger as an adult, he also then became my entry to American studies, in good part also because Ronald Reagan had been quoting him back around 1980 as if Paine was a conservative when in fact he was a revolutionary patriot. Are you still with me, or did I put you guys to sleep yet?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's very fascinating to me. I mean, I was so excited that we would get to talk about Thomas Paine because I too am a Thomas Paine fan.
Fabulous. Oh, great.
Yeah, I think I was just perusing a bookstall in Portland in the late 90s, and I found Samuel Edwards' book, Rebel. I don't know if you know that one. It came out in the
70s. Oh, yeah, sure. I've got them all. Absolutely. I've got a collection that, you know, yeah. I shouldn't actually have.
I'm sure. And, you know, one of the points made in that book is that, you know, first of all, more people need to know about Thomas Paine. You know, he should be on a coin or something that we have. I mean, people should know
right.
who he is, and that the Revolutionary War wouldn't have been successful in large part without his efforts. And the interesting thing that I would think is that nobody makes that case, or nobody has made that case in history more than Thomas Paine himself. And that his years
yeah.
after the Revolutionary War, when he was sort of hitting up President Washington for a little bit more money, you know, it was sort of this little bit, you wouldn't be there if it weren't for me. Can I have some more money, please? And he was sort of, in a way, he was a great propagandist, and towards the end of his life, he was sort of doing that to preserve his point in history, but also to make sure that he wasn't homeless on the streets. And it's just an amazing story,
I mean,
you know, both the beginning,
you know,
and the end.
Yeah, well, you should know that Washington really did want to do everything he could for Paine.
Right.
Washington fully accepted this little rhyme that Joseph Barlow, is that his name, who was the chaplain of the army during the Revolution and then later and was a diplomat as well. He had this little rhyme he had authored. It went, without the pen of Paine, Washington's sword would have been wielded in vain. And Washington fully appreciated the degree to which it was common sense that really did change what was a colonial rebellion into a revolutionary war for independence and a democratic republic. Up until January of 76, all the way through 75, when Washington is already in the field with what becomes the Continental Army up in the Boston area and then they come down to New York, he used to convene his officers for dinner, and the first thing they did is they actually toasted the King of England, George III. And it was only after Paine's Common Sense appeared in January 76 when, I mean, Americans truly were roused to the idea of breaking with Britain and setting up a republic, that Washington speaks all the more openly and all the more fervently of the idea of separation. And he knew all the way through. And then, of course, it is even a full year later, in December 76. This, by the way, is the 240th anniversary this month of Paine's other great pamphlet, which is even quoted even more, the pamphlet, the first of 13 to 16 pamphlets known as the American Crisis Papers. and which opens with the line, which may actually be the most quoted line in American history, aside from maybe lines out of the Declaration and Constitution. That line is, "These are the times that try men's souls." And I can tell you that it's when I did one of those Google searches years ago, and I do it every so often, that's a line quoted not only for political purposes and cultural purposes, but at halftime by the losing coaches in every sport imaginable. You know, "We got to get together, guys. We got to do something." So
that's probably in a few hip hop songs as well, I imagine.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, I actually did a mixtape, they call these things. I actually brought together a whole collection of songs that included everything from folk to rap to punk. I mean, it's just an amazing array. You know, one of the things about Payne is, and I'm with you, I think he should be, if not on a coin, we should at least have a statue of him somewhere on the National Mall. I mean, it's crazy to imagine he's not there when you consider that Washington depended on Payne's pen, that Jefferson and Payne were friends right all the way through to Payne's passing in the early 1800s. And FDR, there's a memorial to FDR as well, FDR quoted Payne at the darkest early days of the American Revolution to try and rally Americans in the wake of Pearl Harbor. Abraham Lincoln read Thomas Paine as a young man and actually bought into not only his politics in some ways, but also his religious ideas about deism. And, I mean, I could go on and on. I see the world through Thomas Paine, you might say.
Well, I'd love to ask you this question, since I have the author here. One of the reasons I come to Paine is in my courses, whether it's an intro-level sociology class or it's a graduate-level social theory class, I always start with a discussion of the Enlightenment and what the Enlightenment meant in terms of the shift of the way we thought about the world from a kind of a religious paradigm to thinking, you know, in terms of rationality and the age of reason and the role of Galileo and all these sort of moments where we really shifted, and that Thomas Paine, along with Jefferson and some of his cohorts, were really kind of the American colonial advocates of that way of thinking, of this rational approach of one man, one vote versus the monarchy and the church. And, you know, these guys, you know, Franklin is going to Paris and hanging out with the philosophers there. And there's this great cross-pollination between these thinkers around these core Enlightenment ideals that lead to first the American Revolution and then the French Revolution. And the French Revolution is seen as being closer in ideal to what the core values of Rousseau and those folks were really about, and that the American Revolution kind of went towards more of a shift of who owned the property. But the point I make in bringing Paine in is that Paine was really much more radical than the revolution itself. You know, he advocated for the end of slavery and for female suffrage, and you know, it was sort of the progressive wing of that. And I wonder where you locate him in the Enlightenment and the manifestation of the Enlightenment in terms of all the revolutionary upheaval of that period.
Well, I subscribe to everything you said. And one thing I would say is, okay, you got a guy like Jefferson, and Jefferson, in many ways, he's this incredibly tragic contradiction. And I say tragic because had he actually truly sought to end slavery, we would have had a different kind of history. But he's this tragic contradiction, the slaveholder who also believes that all men are created equal, right? This tragic contradiction between this really truly Enlightenment thinker and Enlightenment practitioner, but also had a real unease with urban workers. He celebrated the idea of the yeoman farmer, but he was really, really hesitant, if not fearful, of what urban workers might do in any kind of democratic polity. Paine is in many ways the democratic thinker of the Enlightenment. I mean, he's the one who writes in a way that working people, whether they're farmers or artisans or even the lowest of the laboring classes, that they will all understand what he says. And in many ways, what he's quite often doing is not just talking to them about Enlightenment ideas in a way they might understand. He's actually talking to them in a way as to engage their own imaginations, because he believes that what he's saying is pretty much what's on their minds. And I think that you're right. He is the small r, small d, radical democratic figure. of the Enlightenment, and this comes out all the more obviously when he goes back to Europe. After the American Revolution, he stayed on for a while, and he had no real intention to go back, but he was working in science and technology. That was his original love, and he had designed an iron bridge. And the idea for the iron bridge was that he wanted to really unify the states from Massachusetts in the north all the way down to Georgia in the south. And these states were, you know, hugging the eastern seaboard, but to travel from one to the other was nearly impossible to go all the way by land without taking a year and a day. So, and you usually had to go by boat from one seaport to the other. And he thought if you could develop an iron bridge that would be impervious to ice flows and other things and all these rivers that flow into the Atlantic, you'd be able to truly unify what is called the United States into the United States. So he actually developed a model for this, and he couldn't raise the money. He couldn't raise the capital because there was no bank that existed in North America that could underwrite this. And it was Franklin who said to him, now's the time for you to go back to England and France, to London and Paris, to raise money to build an ever larger model in hopes perhaps of getting people to underwrite the building of this bridge. His original plan was to build a bridge in Philadelphia over the Schuylkill River. So he goes back to Europe with the idea of getting funding for his scientific, his technological project, his bridge, and he ends up getting involved very deeply in what really is the efforts on the part of English working people and middle-class people to win the right to vote in Britain, which is not going to happen. It's a failure, but it is the first struggle. It's the first chapter, so you might say, if you ever get around to reading E.P. Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class, those are the struggles that Paine becomes a central figure in. And, of course, at that same time, the French Revolution is breaking out, and Paine ends up going between Paris and London constantly, and he becomes the hero, at least in the of the English labor and radical movement, and in the early days of the French Revolution, you might say. So he's this North Atlantic revolutionary figure who also, by the way, influences revolutionaries in South America in their struggles and or aspirations for independence. Did I answer your question? Sorry if I...
I think a loss of an awareness of the movement of the Enlightenment to change the way we think about social relations and about power and how we can interact with each other. And, you know, there is this inherent irony in it that is, you know, these intellectuals, these people who are more educated than the people they seem to care about, but who are speaking for them on their behalf. And then, so that's why I always kind of clung to Paine, because he was sort of the intellectual of the people. You know, he was the guy I always joke that, you know, Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto for the workers of the world to unite, and they probably looked at it and thought it was something to wipe their asses with, because how are they going to make sense of all these big words? You know, but Paine was this guy who had his sort of finger on the pulse. I mean, it just reminds me of sort of like a contemporary... punk singer or something like that. That's right. So anyway, I think there's reason for him to be celebrated as the kind of joiner of the intellectual movement that brought us all here, the political revolutionary thing that happened because somebody, you know, started making these connections about how we organize ourselves, and then, you know, then the institutionalization of something that looks like at the time one white man with property, one vote, but is smart enough to open itself up to expanding that promise.
Well, the telling line, and we can leave it at that, is in the second edition, well, it's actually officially the third edition, but in Paine's second edition of Common Sense, it came out only a short time after the original, and he has an appendix, and in the appendix it says, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. And that's taking the Enlightenment idea of progress and improvement to its radical conclusion, direction. So, Jennifer, what do you want to ask me?
Sorry, I didn't mean to hijack it, but I just don't think enough people talk about Thomas Paine these days, so I'm excited.
Well, right. I can dig it. You know I can. That's why I've invited you both here. However, I need to stop just a moment for tonight's sponsor. that helps keep me on the air. So if you give me just a moment, everyone listening out there, I know you're loving this as much as I am, maybe more, but got to tell you something else that's very cool. Do you want to learn to flip houses for big chunks of cash? Well, let me tell you about a podcast that gives you the most practical information you can get. Flipper Bill Hawthorne has flipped over 100 properties and loves to give away his secrets in each episode. Every show lets you peek behind the curtain and get practical information on how the industry really works so you too can make some extra income. Now, the name of the show is Flipping Houses for Rookies. It's a podcast, Flipping Houses for Rookies, and you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google iTunes, or go to flippinghouses.club/podcast. The man's name is Bill Hawthorne. He's called the Deal Maker, and he's ready to help you with his podcast, Flipping Houses for Rookies. And thank you so much for being my sponsor tonight, Bill. All right, so back to my gentleman here. I'm still here with Harvey J.K. and Randy Blazak. And if you want to call and ask them a question or comment, the number is 646-716-9922. Keep going. I interrupted you when you were on a roll.
Well, I know that Harvey has a new book out that I'm very intrigued by. So I'm hoping we could talk a little bit about The Four Promises, The Greatest Generation, and what the heck happened to it.
The Four Freedoms.
Right.
The fight for the four freedoms. What made FDR and the Greatest Generation truly great? Where this book comes from, besides the fact that my parents were Greatest Generation couple, is that I could not get over the fact that on the one hand, you had all of these conservatives who were immediately embracing the Greatest Generation and celebrating them for their service in World War II, but completely doing their damnedest, and this included Ronald Reagan, to suppress the memory of the fact, and I believe this sincerely, that that generation, for all of its faults and failings, for all of its, you know, who among us doesn't suffer from racism, sexism, and everything else that America, is afflicted by. But the fact is, for all of that, that generation was possibly, well, arguably, I actually do believe, the most progressive generation in American history. If you think about the arc of that generation from the 1930s, when they were in their teens, to through the 1960s, when they were in their 40s. And if you imagine that this was the generation that confronted the Great Depression, that enlisted in the New Deal, that organized labor unions, that enabled FDR to enact with his Democratic Congress Social Security, the National Labor Relations Act, and a host of other very progressive laws, and transformed the American landscape by way of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration, the Rural Electrification Agency, things like that. Mm-hmm. And you think about the battles in World War II against fascism and Japanese imperialism. And then again, for all of their faults and failings, this was the generation – not mine, because most of us were too young. We could march, but we couldn't vote. But in the 1960s, when challenged by a younger generation to act, this was the generation that actually did enact civil rights, voting rights, Medicare, Medicaid, radically changed the immigration laws in the Immigration Act of 1965, created environmental protection, workplace protection, consumer protection, created the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, public broadcasting, built university campuses such as my own University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. I mean, this was an extraordinary progressive generation from the 30s to the 60s. And while conservatives were ready to celebrate them as a wartime generation, and I would not argue with them about that, they wanted to suppress the memory of all the other things they accomplished. And meanwhile, folks on the left, my own comrades on the left, were in a knee-jerk way sort of rejecting the idea of the Greatest Generation because somehow that Greatest Generation hadn't, you know, turned the world completely upside down in favor of the things that we thought were all the more important. So I thought it was important to remind Americans of the radicalism and the progressivism that took place in those decades because we were losing touch not just with the memory, But in fact, after 40 years of class war, which is what we've seen ever since the late 70s, we've lost touch with the kinds of progressive reforms that they enacted. And I can tell you right now that in the course of the next year, in the wake of the Trump victory in November, and Paul Ryan and McConnell salivating to pass legislation, we're going to see a really awful and ugly onslaught on what's left of the FDR legacy.
There's a wonderful section in Todd Gitlin's book on the 60s. Mm-hmm. He wrote it when he was at Berkeley, and I think he's at Columbia now, where he's trying to come up with a sort of explanation of why the 60s were the 60s. And he writes about the red diaper babies, that, you know, many of these baby boomers had parents who were those frontline progressives and members of, you know, the International Workers of the World and various union movements and immigrant rights movements that are almost sort of forgotten by contemporary history. That, you know, we think of Woody Guthrie, and that's about as far as our knowledge of sort of the contemporary voices of the first half of the 20th century go. And in fact, that they passed down their views about power relations to the kids.
You know, it's interesting, Randy. If you look at the names in the 60s who really were, I don't mean young names like Tom Hayden or Todd Gitlin and others. If you look at the folks who were themselves already into their 40s in the 60s who led the real struggles that made the 60s the 60s, not just sex, drugs, rock and roll, and protests in the street, almost all of them are Greatest Generation folks. This includes A. Philip Randolph, who the black labor and civil rights leader. It includes Walter Reuther, who led the UAW and was the most progressive of the white labor – well, one of the most progressive white labor leaders, was actually a socialist for many years. I'm blanking all of a sudden. I cannot believe I'm blanking. Who wrote The Feminine Mystique? Not The Feminine Mystique.
Betty Friedan,
who I shouldn't have forgotten because I actually knew her for a little while. Betty Friedan was a labor journalist who came out of the battles of the 40s. Rachel Carson was actually for Silent Spring, who was the sort of godmother of the environmental movement of the 60s. She was in the FDR Fish and Wildlife Service in the 30s and 40s. I could just go way on and on and on through the list. And these folks who really lay out the agenda for the 60s are all themselves, you know, veterans of the struggles of the 1930s New Deal against the Great Depression. And many of them, in fact, veterans of World War II. So it's that arc. And I think that, I mean, I've got a piece coming out. This should be out Saturday at Salon. I think it'll be titled Newt Gingrich Declares War Once Again on the Age of Roosevelt. He spoke last week at the Heritage Foundation, and, you know, he's always full of it. He laid out the greatest presidents in American history list and included Trump as the next member of that list. And he was trying to persuade the Heritage folk who might have serious reservations about Trump, but trying to persuade them to embrace him. But was saying basically that this is our chance, right, to bring a final end to the age of Roosevelt. And what they mean by that is they want to go after Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, what remains of the National Labor Relations Act, probably would like to overturn the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, which, of course, was Lyndon Johnson's doing, along with Manuel Sellers, of the congressman from Brooklyn, New York. I mean, this is really could be one of the worst moments of the last 50 years in American history, I think. But it also could turn out to be one of the most progressive turnarounds if we can all get it together.
In Washington Monthly, back in 2014, Harvey, I think it was in the summer, you probably read this, Moshe Z. Marvitt.
Moshe Marvitt, I've never met him, but I know him.
Okay, so he wrote the review of the Fight for the Four Freedoms, and titled his review, The Liberals' Call to Real Liberty. But I remember what really got me, stayed with me more than anything, was the last paragraph where he says, in the fight for the four freedoms, Kay is as much trying to recover a lost history as pushing a progressive call to arms. Throughout the book, one cannot help but notice the parallels between the Greatest Generation and our own. Both periods are marked by high unemployment, low wages, increased inequality, and wealth and power concentrated in the hands of a few. The first step toward doing something about it is to remember the courage and radicalism of the previous generation and the world it created. The second step is to guard it.
Right. I mean, you know, in fact, with all due respect to my colleague in sociology, one of the reasons that I moved very quickly back to history, even when I was in sociology, I wrote historical sociology, was the fact that I really think that we on the left, those of us who are on the left, and liberals, progressives and radicals have generally failed to lay their, you know, really to lay claim to American history, to take hold of American history and remind their fellow citizens that fundamentally, and this is actually the title of my next book, that fundamentally Americans are radicals at heart. I mean, we've got a history that's filled with tragedy and irony. It's got, I mean, we have a lot to atone for in the exploitation and oppression that we've witnessed in this country. But it is the case that fundamentally when we're at our best, or if you like, when Lincoln referred to the better angels of our nature, what he meant was that at our best, we are radicals at heart. We're progressives, that we don't suspend our values in the face of a crisis. We actually pursue them. We enhance, we make America all the more free, equal, and democratic, even if we don't accomplish all of those things. And I think that history and a narrative and an understanding empowers people. You know, I tweeted today something that dawned on me, you know, reflecting on Barack Obama's, you know, campaigns and presidency. There was all the talk, you may recall, of hope, or even Bill Clinton for that matter, back, you know, in 1992, the guy from Hope, all that kind of stuff. And I thought, we don't need hope. What we need is memory. We need to remember, and out of the memory, then the hope will emerge. Hope otherwise, you know, it could be literally a fog. I think we need to remember. And in fact, the opening paragraphs of my book on the fight for the four freedoms says we need to remember. And I lay out, we need to remember these things. And then I go back to tell the story of that generation. The other reason I wrote the book is that as much as I admire, and I believe Roosevelt is rightly considered one of the three greatest presidents in American history, again, for all of his mistakes and the tragic mistakes they were, the fact is that as he accomplished all these things, not simply because of who he was, he accomplished these things because he had incredible confidence in his fellow citizens and the kind of confidence that enabled him to be pushed by them. There's actually a famous story. Some people don't even know if it's true or not, but I actually can give you an example of when it was true, and I'll do that. In 1941, in the spring of 1941, the United States is not yet in World War II, but Roosevelt gave the Four Freedoms speech in January of 41, the State of the Union address, when he basically told Americans, we have to become the arsenal of democracy, and we have to make sure that Britain and its allies can withstand the Nazi onslaught, and because they're coming for us next, and we need to prepare. So he says that it isn't simply a matter of preparing, and we ought not to suspend or put an end to what we've been working towards in the New Deal 1930s. We need to actually expand the New Deal. And he lays out this vision of the four freedoms. He says, you know, we have to make sure that the world to come is marked by four fundamental freedoms: freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Now, A. Philip Randolph, whose name I mentioned before, the great labor and civil rights leader, he was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He had the great idea that this was the time to act, and he came up with the original plan for what doesn't even occur until 63, the March on Washington. So he's got this idea that he's going to mobilize 10,000 African Americans to come to Washington, to march in Washington, to demand the desegregation of the defense industries and possibly the desegregation of the American military. So anyhow, the word goes out, and demonstrations are held in all the major northern cities. And Roosevelt's anxious. He's worried about this. He's not so much worried about 10,000 African-Americans marching. I mean, A. Philip Randolph was a friend by way of his friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt. He was worried that if they came to D.C., which was then a segregated city, that white racists would mobilize and there would be massive violence. So anyhow, he tries to get Eleanor to get A. Philip Randolph to call off the march. And Randall says, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. So Roosevelt invites A. Philip Randolph and a man named Walter White, who then headed the NAACP, to the White House for a conversation. Roosevelt figured he would use his personal charm to talk them out of the march. And they're sitting in the Oval Office, and Roosevelt says to him, so now listen, how many people do you expect to bring to D.C.? And Randolph, without skipping a beat, says 100,000. He upped the number by 10. And Roosevelt was a bit startled, or at least we're told he's startled. And he turned to Walter White and said, what did he say? And White said 100,000. So then Roosevelt said, well, I guess we ought to do something. And that led to his signing an executive order, which basically said that the war industries, if they were going to get federal contracts, had to open up job opportunities to African Americans. And also he created the Fair Employment Practice Commission to oversee all of that. Now, the interesting thing is this. When Randolph left the White House, you could say, what a victory. You know, he totally, you know, he changed Roosevelt's mind. But Randolph was smart, and he knew the Roosevelts. And he wrote in a letter to someone that he knew as soon as he got the invitation to come to the White House that he would have his way. He knew it because he knew enough about Roosevelt that Roosevelt operated on these terms. And now here's the story they would tell. That reformers would come to the White House to try to persuade Roosevelt to push a certain bill through Congress. And Roosevelt would look at them and say, look, you've persuaded me. Now make me do it. And what he meant was, don't make me do it. Go out and stage enough protests so that Congress has to do it, and I can push them to act. And in essence, what Randolph knew was that Roosevelt wanted these things to happen. He needed to be empowered by these things, by the possibility of marches and struggles. So, I mean, that's a guy, you know, that's a president who had faith in his fellow citizens. And by the way, millions of workers in the 1930s jumped at the opportunity to organize labor unions. Housewives, they actually created the first national housewives movement, demanding some kind of regulation of prices. I mean, it's an extraordinary time. And I think that what we need to remember is not just that FDR did all of this, but all of these unionists and women and civil rights organizers who really did begin the civil rights movement anew in the 1930s, that they're the ones with Roosevelt who made the Four Freedoms as an idea possible, victory in World War II possible, and this great arc of New Deal and Great Society.
You know, there is there's always sort of another story to be told, and that's such an important story, but I couldn't help but thinking about the same time period when the internment of the Japanese began, and
absolutely,
that, you know, there were voices in Roosevelt's ear, including Eleanor, including the Attorney General Francis Biddle. I think the governor of Colorado was against it. There were these voices saying, you know, this is not constitutional. These people are most part citizens and farming and minding their own business. But there was this incredible hysteria at the time, including, you know, acts of violence in newspapers saying we need to round these people up. Look what they did at Pearl Harbor, that pushed them in the other direction. So it seems like that's kind of the counter story to the one you told, where there, you know, it was the more I don't know if racist is the right word, but the more paranoid, xenophobic voices that sort of made him do it in 1942.
Yeah, now, look, I talk about that in the book. I mean, the three great tragedies would be, first, the fact that Roosevelt and Robert Wagner, the great senator from New York, the German-American senator, could not get Congress to change the immigration quotas. Don't forget, the United States Immigration Act of 1924 limited immigration from Central Eastern Europe.
I mean, yeah,
they
was
could
the great
not get Congress
of the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s.
Yeah, they could not get Congress to change the law. And the United States took more refugees than any other country, but not nearly what would have been necessary. So the first great one is the tragedy of not opening the door to Jewish refugees. The second great tragedy is the allowing the U.S. military to create a Jim Crow segregated army where African Americans, 1 million African Americans, were in separate regiments and companies. Now, the only thing I can tell you is that, in at least regarding that, and then third is the greatest civil rights tragedy in American history, the internment of West Coast Japanese Americans. Now, there's a great deal of irony in every one of those things, but let me, since you brought up the case of the Japanese Americans, which I think is really significant historically, there's so much irony around that, it's just astonishing to me. And I'll just mention for what it's worth that my dearest friend for many, many years here at UW Green Bay was born in an internment camp in Arkansas while his father was serving in American military intelligence, Japanese-American in military intelligence during World War II. I mean, the irony was that even as these Japanese-American families were interned, although some did refuse to serve under the circumstances, 22,000 Japanese-Americans served in uniform and became the most decorated combat unit of World War II.
Right, the 442nd.
Right, exactly. And the irony, of course, is that Pearl Harbor, of course, is in Hawaii, and no Japanese-Americans were rounded up in Hawaii and interned, only West Coast Americans. And by the way, there was no internment of Japanese Americans if they lived in the Midwest or the Eastern Seaboard, only the West Coast. The irony there gets compounded by the fact that one of the men pushing for the internment was Earl Warren, a Republican from California,
right,
who, of course, later becomes the Eisenhower-appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and leads the most liberal Supreme Court in America, well, one of the most liberal Supreme Courts in American history, including the first major act in the the first really historic desegregation decision, Brown v. Board of Education. I mean, the ironies of all of these things. I mean, our country has got a history of tragedy and irony, so I don't skate over those things. But the point I want to make here is that what's interesting in World War II, in spite of those tragedies, the groups of Americans who might have had the greatest reason not to serve with mm-hmm. Fervent spirit actually served out of proportion to their numbers when they were allowed to. So a greater number of Jews served in uniform during World War II as a percentage of the military than were a percentage of the population. African Americans, 1 million served, they were limited by a quota act, so they couldn't actually serve in greater numbers. Native Americans served out of proportion to their numbers in the general population. Mexican Americans, 400,000 served in World War II, well out of proportion to their numbers. And I could go on and on. And it's really an extraordinary story. And in that sense, for all of his, sort of bad decisions, I mean, historically bad decisions, it's also the case that Roosevelt's basic instincts about trusting his fellow citizens were right, and he should have gone with those instincts and not allowed the generals and the West Coast Republicans to tell him otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, Harvey and Randy, I could keep you guys here all night.
I'm stopping myself because I feel like this conversation could go on and on and on. There's so many wonderful stories.
I know. Yeah.
Connect together.
George Takei was on John Fugel's thing a week ago and talking the same thing about when him and his brother looking out the window and seeing soldiers coming with bayonets to round them up. And he said, naturally the young Japanese men, like every other young man, was ready to go sign up and go to war. And I was like, oh, no, you're not. You're going here.
Do you have time for one more story? Can I tell you one more story about the irony of all this?
Under one condition. That you and Randy promise to come back and do a part two sometime.
Yeah. Oh, happily, without reservation.
Okay, all right.
This last thing is truly to me is like one of the most ironic things going as a personal story. So we all know of Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, the Democrat,
right.
Passed away not too many years ago, I guess. Who served in a Japanese American from Hawaii, served in uniform in the 442nd, the originally 100th combat team, then the 442nd. So he tells the story that they went into training in the Deep South. I can't remember if it's Mississippi or Alabama, and where a lot of the U.S. Army got sent to train. And while they were there, and now don't forget, Americans were outraged by Pearl Harbor, but while they were there, these Japanese Americans in uniform, were in the local community the families of the local community held stage dances so that these Japanese Americans could come off base and meet their daughters, these Southern white girls. Now, I mean, you got to admit, that's striking given the racism that was being expressed about Japanese Americans, right?
So right.
So he goes off to fight in Europe, and there again, I say, you know, as Randy knows, the 442nd was the most decorated combat team.
Yeah.
So, and he lost his arm in the war. It was actually an accident; a grenade went off. So he comes back, and he's in California, and he's being demobilized, and he goes off base to get himself a haircut, and the local barber says, "We don't cut Jap hair." And he's just come out of uniform as a wounded veteran. I mean, you know, we go from the strange story of being welcomed in the South, the most racist part of the country, we're told, and then he ends up in California, okay? The hostility towards Japanese Americans in California was so great that he suffered that kind of racism. And then, of course, later he gets elected to the U.S. Senate. So
this is another person like Thomas Paine that I'm a staunch advocate that more people need to know about. He was also crucial in statehood for Hawaii after the war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he played a role in that as well. So,
right.
I mean, this is a guy who there's a lot of stories that go along with Senator Inouye for sure.
Yeah, right. So that was the final thing I wanted to say, okay, for tonight at least.
Oh, no, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that you told the story. And that's a great story. It's a bizarre, it goes against what everyone expects. Of us here in the South, like myself, and in California. What a story. It has been such a thrill to have you here, Harvey J.K. I know when I first asked you, your first response to me was, "Do you know anything about me? Have you read anything of mine?"
Well, I sometimes wonder. I mean, I've done a lot of right-wing radio, too, and although I often surprise them because I can out-patriot them, in fact. which I think we on the left should have been doing more often, because I think we underestimate the degree to which our fellow citizens have an inbuilt not only radicalism but a kind of patriotic fervor. And we shouldn't forget that all of these young immigrants from Asia and Mexico and other places, they want to be American. They don't want to be the other. They want to be American.
Yes, they do. They do, and they hold that very dear to their hearts, to want to be Americans. So you're going to definitely both come back. Yeah, Randy Blazak, I was afraid to ask him to be on the show, and then he told me before I could ask him. He goes, "I got a new book. Why don't I come on there?" Okay, I thought, well, if he says yes, maybe Harvey will say yes. And so, I am thrilled to have you both here. We're going to do a part two when you gentlemen both have an evening free for me. For everyone listening, thank you so much. Don't forget to get a copy of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, as well as his other books, Thomas Paine, The Promise of America, and everything else. Randy Blazak's newest book is The Dream Police. And the book just before that it's the sequel to, Randy, what's the title again? I don't want to get it wrong.
The Mission of the Sacred Heart. The Mission of the Sacred Heart.
Mission of the Sacred Heart. And, of course, I'll have links to both of these gentlemen's websites and their works and everything. And thanks again to my sponsor, Flipping Houses for Rookies. Oh, my friend Diane Wilkie messaged in, and she said, ask. she said she wished she could be here. She just thinks you're fascinating, Harvey. And she said, do you know her college boyfriend, Jeff Valbush, who directs the Honors College at University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire?
I feel like you know what? That's a funny question, because that's on the other side of the – I don't, and that's on the other side of the state, which is actually quite a bit of – it's quite distant from Green Bay. It's maybe a – I don't want to exaggerate – 4-hour drive from here. So I more often drive south towards Milwaukee and Chicago than I do west to Eau Claire. But I'm sure he's a great guy.
Well, I told her I would ask, and as I was reading it, I feel like Garrison Keillor at the end of Prairie Home Companion, you know, or the middle when they read all the messages from the audience.
Yeah, right. Right. Randy, it was a pleasure to meet you. I look forward to meeting
you
face-to-face
sometime. Yeah,
you too. And Jennifer, I look forward to talking to you again sometime, and who knows, maybe running into you in my – by the way, there's a group of guys down in Sarasota, Florida. I meet with every late January to celebrate Thomas Paine's birthday. and they are Florida Veterans for Common Sense, and I always fly through Atlanta on the way, so if you're around the airport, let me know.
I will do that. I will definitely do that. And Randy has ties in Atlanta as well, so you never know when he'll show up there as well. I certainly will. Thank you both. You've both been a pure delight.